It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Today, the quantified self. If you haven't heard, there's a new watch out. And according to Tim Cook, it'll change your life.
Apple Watch is the most personal device we've ever created. A comprehensive health and fitness device. An Apple Watch gives us the ability to motivate people to be more active and more healthy. Apple Watch helps you live a better day.
But does it? I mean, how much do you really want to know about yourself? Because Apple Watch is just the beginning. Call it life logging, self-tracking, health and fitness monitoring. The market for personal technology is exploding. There are apps and gadgets to track just about every mundane, tiny little thing you do.
There are apps that track how much water we drink. There are some devices that will help you to breathe more deeply. There's also the idle alert. It vibrates when you have been sitting for 20 minutes and kind of reminds you that you might want to stretch or move your legs.
I'm Anne Strange-Shamps, and this is Natasha Dow-Schull. For the past few years, she has wandered the aisles at the gigantic annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. She's a cultural anthropologist at MIT, and what she's noticing is the emergence of something new, the quantified self, along with some pretty bizarre new inventions.
It's called the Pavlok, which is a play on Pavlov, obviously, and it's a wristband linked to your cell phone. It's the same technology as cattle prods, and you can tell it, you know, if I'm browsing too long on Facebook, zap me.
The one I read about that really knocked me out is the thing called the Happy Fork.
So the Happy Fork is an easy one to make fun of. It's a fork that will measure how long you're chewing for in between bites. And if that duration is less than, I believe, 10 seconds, it will kind of buzz and oscillate in your hand. And the instructions say, if your Happy Fork starts to vibrate, do not panic. Set it down next to your plate. And when it glows green again, it will be safe to start eating once again. I mean, some people swear by it, and they can review retrospectively at the end of the week their chewing and meal habits.
So this is a way to outsource willpower, seems like. I mean, instead of setting a goal, you know, reducing your calorie intake or spending less time on Facebook, you have a gadget that basically prods you into keeping to your resolutions.
Yeah, I think outsourcing willpower is a great way to see it. And I do remember even reading a quote in a piece that was done, I believe, in Forbes about this technology. And the designer in question said, why do we need to waste our willpower on all of these tiny, tedious, obvious little things? Let's free up our, you know, willpower bandwidth for bigger, more consequential decisions and, you know, let this technology help regulate us in all these little pesky ways.
Wow. So I'll be the first to admit that I'm not a person who tracks things. But even if I did, this seems like information overload. I mean, I read that you talked with someone from one of these companies who said that her product gathers about 5,000 data points a minute off of the body. I mean, what do you even do with all of that? What's it for?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the latest thinking is that rather than showing people numbers all the time, you only get in touch with them about it when there's something important. A great example of this would be the new wave of weighing scales. So to us, it makes sense that you get on a scale so that you can see your number.
Mm-hmm.
But these new scales aren't going to show numbers.
That's a relief.
Right. They may just have little voices that say, have a nice day. And what that means is nothing to waste your cognitive bandwidth on or your willpower. Go about your day. Everything's fine. I will only bother you if there's a significant error signal in your weight that you should know about. So there's a new wave of products that just kind of run in the background. Maybe you sign on to them. You might set up the initial parameters, how much it'll ask little questions, how much do you want to know, when do you want to know it. And then you just let it run and go about your life, trusting that it will be collecting this continuous data and it will tell you if there's something important for you to know.
So you spent some time with members of the quantified self movement. Tell me about them.
So members of the quantified self movement tend to be more of the kind of techno-libertarian, geeky sort. A lot of men, a lot of engineers. It's a very DIY kind of community where you give show and tells that are 15 minutes and you need to say, what did you track? How did you track it? What did you learn? And you share that with the community.
What do people track?
They track everything from the quality and number of their orgasms to their water intake, their sleep, their moods. And typically what they're trying to do, and this is something that the Apple Watch is also trying to do, is find patterns, detect patterns, and draw correlations across two or more data streams. So the idea isn't simply to know how much water or the number of your orgasms and things like that, but how might those relate to the quality of your sleep, your caffeine intake. Some algorithms have even been written to analyze the semantic content of your email exchanges or who are you talking to? And it could be that your mood dips at a certain time of the day because that's likely when you'll get a call from your mother. Something like this. The idea is that there's this kind of detective-like quality in quantified self where you're trying to hunt down these clues to things that are not obvious to you by using big data analytics and these gadgets.
You know, that's really kind of fascinating. I mean, it's the kind of thing that people used to go to therapists for, right? To tease out your subconscious motivations and what's really going on in your life and what kind of self-talk are you engaging in and how does that affect your mood? And now it seems like we're doing it with algorithms and data.
As an anthropologist, I think there's more to the difference there because the kind of person that something like a therapeutic or psychoanalytic approach assumes is a person whose psyche you can excavate. It's there to be uncovered and revealed. And this kind of self that is at stake in continuous tracking and big data analysis is quite different. One of the self trackers I spoke with said, I think of myself as a time series self, where the self unfolds in many little bits over time, and you sort of check in when a sufficient amount of time and data has built up to see what clues might be revealed there.
So I have to say, one of the things that I really value about life is its messiness. I like it that people are chaotic and not rational. I mean, that's part of why we have literature, right? Because we have life stories that are rich and complex. Something about the sense of self you're describing and the kind of tracking seems, you know, it seems like it's all about control.
I think quantification, this sort of numerical imagination, is related in interesting ways to messiness and playfulness. Hmm. It doesn't have to be this completely top-down control that sucks the life out of everything. I think it's too easy to dismiss this stuff on those grounds. I had my graduate students take a class I called Self as Data. And in that class, we tried to compare contemporary apps and tracking gadgets with historical precursors. And one really interesting one was Sanctorius in the 1700s. He developed a special, what he called the weighing chair, and he would sit in it as he ate every meal, and it would weigh the sort of insensate perspiration, he called it. So it was very accurate, and as he ate, the chair would actually lower down. You know, it was basically an algorithm that dictated when he had had enough, the chair was too low for him to reach the table. So it's not that different in the way that it was imagined and the way that it functioned from many of the caloric intake weight loss apps that you'll find today on iPhones.
And I suppose the point you're making is that long before digital technology existed, we were doing this. I mean, think about, you know, diary keepers like Ben Franklin, who kept track of just literally everything.
Right. And Ben Franklin wasn't simply a diary writer because he had a special ivory tablet with these 13 columns for these 13 virtues, as he called them, which are very related to the kind of virtues, if we want to use that language, that a lot of this tracking is about today. It was, has he been gluttonous? Did he get to sleep on time? Other things like this. And he would actually have tick off the little boxes every day and then erase it and start again. So many people point to Franklin as one of the first American trackers.
I guess it sounds like what you're saying is that the technology may have changed, but the underlying attitude has been the same for hundreds of years. And the underlying attitude being self-improvement.
Or even to be a sort of ethical, ascetic project of what is it to lead a good life? What, this is a long-standing question of how actually to be a better human and lead a good life. I'm not sure that the attitude has remained the same across history, and I'm not sure that the digital doesn't change it in some way when it comes on the scene.
For instance?
Just as one example, I do think that nowadays it's also about a lot of anxiety. How exactly do I manage myself? You know, there's competing expertise out there in the news telling you what to eat, when to sleep. There is already information overload there. Mm-hmm. And I think people are desperate for something to guide them and track them and share the burden of self-regulation. It's self-improvement, but it's also submission. There's a significant degree of submission over to technology and big data analytics.
That's interesting because you're talking about anxiety, and I was thinking, going back to where we began, talking about apps and gadgets that monitor essentially stuff around health and fitness. And I was thinking, yeah, you know, health used to be something you had until you lost it. But with all of these gadgets, it seems like the assumption is that health is something so precarious that you have to constantly be monitoring it.
Yeah, I think this technology accords with a present in which the real health demons are not acute bacterial infections that are sort of invisible and then suddenly they're there and you treat them, but lifestyle diseases, diseases where you have a choice, as I've heard it talked about, diabetes, back pain, all of these things that creep up on you in tiny little bits. And I think it's precisely these lifestyle diseases of modern life that offer themselves as trackable to digital technology.
Well, and no wonder we're terrified. You know, if the message we're getting is that all those tiny little incremental choices we make every day, whether to take the stairs or not, you know, those things are going to kill us. So of course we're anxious.
Right. And we're also anxious because we are living in a consumer society and we are exhorted at every turn of, you know, in the mall or on the street or on our phones as we're riding the bus to consume this, to consume that, eat this, drink this. It is a sort of bombardment. And, you know, I learned a while back about a technology. You can load this app onto your iPhone or your smartphone and go into a supermarket and hold it out up to the labels, scan them, and it will tell you whether this food is safe or where it falls on the sort of yellow to red to green scale. And it's almost like these are little shields. You know, this is this dangerous landscape of temptation inside the supermarket. And we've been reduced to arming ourselves with these little apps to protect ourselves both from the array of products and also from our own desires.
Natasha Dow Schull is a cultural anthropologist at MIT. She's got a book on self-tracking due out next year. It's called Keeping Track. Now, one of the more prominent members of the quantified self community is a guy named Nicholas Felton. He's a former Facebook designer, and he's also an obsessive self-tracker. And for him, the issue isn't how much data you can collect about yourself, it's what to do with it. And because he's a designer, he makes his personal data beautiful. He calls his data sets his annual reports, and some of them are actually in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Sarah Nix talked with him.
What's the first thing you tracked about yourself?
The first thing that got me hooked on investigating my own habits was a website called Last.fm. And this allowed me to connect all the songs that I played in iTunes to a website. This was this whole really interesting area of my life in which I had almost complete transparency into my habits. And that kind of led me on this quest of wanting to have that perspective on other aspects of my life. It might be a quirk of my personality, but I think that there's this interesting rift between the way that we describe ourselves, our own like unquantified self-image, our qualitative view of ourselves, and what's quantified. So it's nice to me when these things link up, but it's also nice to discover biases in your behavior that you didn't really understand.
It's like being your own anthropologist or something.
Yeah, or just hitting record on your life and then seeing what comes out of it.
We should explain what the annual reports are. Can you just explain how they work and when you started doing them?
Sure. So the annual report is a project that I undertake every single year, and I've been doing it for about 9 years now. The report takes the form of me tracking some set of behaviors over the course of the year, and then in January, sitting down and trying to create data visualizations and quantifications of the activities that I undertook over the course of the year. I'm trying to create as complete a record of my life as I can in the 16 pages of this printed book that I produce at the end of the year.
What's the value of the kind of over the course of the year view for you?
So I think a lot of the products that people use that quantify their life, they're focused on optimization. And optimization of all aspects of my life is not an explicit goal. So I'm merely driven by this curiosity about whether you can quantify different behaviors and whether there's something useful at the end of that data stream. So is there an interesting story or a curious factoid or a pattern that sort of lays bare your behavior in one single graph?
Well, I'm really kind of fascinated to hear that you didn't just assume that there would be value in looking at the year as a whole, like that you went in looking to see whether there would be value in the experiment. I mean, I assume that you put all that energy in because you believed utterly that it would be valuable.
Yeah, I don't know if that enough people have worked with this data to actually know what the value is. And over the course of this project, it's been fun to work with quantifying things that I don't think have been very deeply explored yet and to see if there is any value with it.
I want to make it really clear to everybody who's listening that the visual representations you make are often really beautiful. They're very elaborate. They're kind of compelling. They look a little mysterious, like you want to spend some time with them to get to the bottom of what's actually happening in the visualizations. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, are there ways in which the visualizations in all their beauty and depth can actually be misleading? You know, it's that like lies, damn lies, statistics, and now it's like visualized statistics, even worse, more seductive.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at my reports, it's an act of exploration for myself. So I'm trying to find something that resonates for me. And, you know, my editorial process in making these is not to mislead people about my behavior. I don't want to share my most intimate secrets in these reports, but I'm hoping that there is some sort of pattern that appears that is unique to me and is not there simply for the sake of being seductive.
You have worked with at least one other person's data, right? Your dad's. Can you tell me about that project?
Certainly. My dad was born in 1929 in Berlin, and he lived a long and full life before I was ever born. And he had an incredible set of travel stories. And my sister and I, for years, really wanted him to write down his life story for us to pass on to our family. And we spent some time videotaping him talking about it. But, you know, ultimately, he slipped through our fingers and he passed away. And I didn't feel like I had a great grasp of how his life had progressed. And as my sister and I were going through the mementos he left behind, I started setting aside these piles of data-rich personal belongings, like his passports and his letters, receipts that he'd kept. And at a certain point, I realized that his personal history was stored in all these mementos. And I asked my sister if she'd be all right with me parsing it and trying to figure out if I could rebuild his life story from these mementos. And she gave me her blessing. So I think it took about 2 months to go through everything. And ultimately, I was able to step through his life sort of decade by decade, matching up like an old photo from a passport with this quantified view of like what his early years in Berlin were like, all the way through to living like the 50s and 60s in Canada and coming to the Bay Area in the 70s. And then my sister and I showing up and how this impacted his life. And
do you feel like you knew him better at the end of all of that?
I did. It was a very therapeutic process of just being, you know, sort of meditating over his stuff and learning these things about his life. Ultimately, like, we had a memorial for him, and I had these printed reports, and it was amazing to me that I was able to hand it to his 70 and 80-year-old friends, and they immediately got it and, you know, could identify themselves in the apartments he lived in or the museums that he'd gone to or the restaurants that he liked. And so that was very heartwarming for me, and I think it was almost like this, you know, literal scattering of his ashes, being able to send these reports to people who collect them, like in Europe and in South America. And so I liked the idea that he's living on in all these people's libraries around the world.
You know, after I took a moment and sat back and took a deep breath after going through some of the reports, I started to think about how mystics and scientists and philosophers as well have over the centuries asked what life is. And I wondered, particularly with your dad's project and maybe with the culmination of all of your projects, what you're trying to do is figure out what life is. Can it be quantified?
Yeah, I mean, if I get mystic about it, I do have this, I don't know, almost like philosopher's goal in mind that perhaps if I collect just the right data and represent it in just the right way, it'll all make sense.
Nicholas Felton's personal data visualizations are in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. And he's also designed an app to help other people obsessively document their lives. It's called Reporter. Sarah next talked with him. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and coming up, we'll meet a genius computer scientist with the largest personal data set in the world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. One of the big questions in the quantified self movement is what to do with all your data. You know, like, let's say you've tracked all the websites you've visited for the past year or every dessert you've eaten. Now, what do you do with it? You can make it visual with charts and graphs and maps. But our producer for this hour, Craig Ely, is also interested in another way to represent data, sonically. Plus, he's a bit of a life logger himself.
Just a little bit. Although I do use Nicholas Felton's Reporter app.
I knew it. So how do you turn your personal data into sound, though?
Well, I don't do it myself. That's the first thing. Last year, I was working at Penn State, and I had a chance to meet this guy, Matt Kenny. He was a graduate student there, and he does this project that he calls data sonifications. The basic idea is that instead of plotting data on two dimensions, like you mentioned in a graph, you take data points and you map them to sonic elements, the, you know, frequency and volume, things that can change over time.
So what does that sound like?
Well, you'll find out. I called Matt and gave him some of my own data. I asked him to work with it. This is a process that can sometimes take him months. I asked him to do it in a few days. So it was a big favor. But we got to talking, and I also asked him a lot about his work and whether or not he thinks it's a kind of music.
So that's a question that's really up for debate. I consider it music or a type of musicality. If you think about a composer like Brian Eno, let's say, who uses algorithms to compose his music, or Yannis Xenakis is another one who used algorithms and chance to kind of compose his pieces. I think data sonification might fall in that vein. So really, we're just using the data as a way to drive composition. On the other side, it can also really be used as a scientific tool or a way to gather information and bring a new understanding to the data that you couldn't say in a couple of line graphs or in a bar chart.
So Matt, a few days ago, I gave you a data set that tracks basically all the time I've spent on my computer for the first 100 days of this year. And that's broken down into categories. So walk me through this. Once you get that big old spreadsheet filled with numbers, what does your process look like?
So the first step is kind of cleaning the data. So I'll go through and make sure everything is cleaned up, fill in any gaps. And then I go and read it into a program called SuperCollider, which is a computer programming language. And then do just some general mapping. So I'll take each data point, each variable, and map it to a different instrument, and then start designing the instruments and let it go from there.
So what does the sound of me surfing the internet on my computer sound like?
So in thinking about this data set, I mean, computers are remarkably quiet, right? So it felt like I had a little bit of wiggle room to like really play around with these sounds. For instance, one of the categories was communication and scheduling, and I just kind of designed a sound around the Gmail sound that you might hear on your phone, the kind of like da-ding of getting a Gmail, and then mapping that to the data set.
That's fantastic. I mean, I spend a ton of time in my email. I mean, at work,
sure,
or business stuff. I mean, I'm guessing that's probably one of the more prominent sounds that you had to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you actually spent a lot of time in communication and scheduling. So I think that'll be a pretty prominent sound when you listen to the sonification.
So talk about another sound.
Yeah, so news was another category. So how much time you spent on different news sites. And I enjoy reading the news from time to time, but generally I find it kind of annoying and a little depressing. So so I thought maybe a saw wave, maybe like a buzzing sound, like a zzzz, going in your ear. So as the time that you spent surfing these news sites goes up, you'll hear the frequency of that saw wave go up.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the time I spent data logging. What does that sound like?
So thinking about a sound for data logging itself. So maybe it's just like, maybe it's like a ticking sound. Maybe it's just like checking a box off, like a tick.
Okay, so when you put it all together, what does all my data sound like? I know that you've worked with really big historical data. I mean, obviously, I think the spreadsheet I gave you is some of the most important data you've ever worked with. But I understand that you've actually used this, you know, you've done work with this really massive data set that had to do with Antarctic ice melt.
Yeah, so I worked with a Polar Center at Penn State, a group of really great scientists that collected this data and projected a little bit back into the past and then into the future to get these 400,000 years of Antarctic ice melt. In designing that, we really stuck to kind of more representational sounds. Mm-hmm. So again, maybe for solar radiation, you could kind of like hear like this like tingling sound, like maybe sun hitting the ice, or for the ice melting, you could hear it was like kind of like a rattling of like ice cubes in a glass.
Yeah, sure.
And then as far as the sonification is concerned, I think what sonification brings to the table is being able to digest multiple layers simultaneously. So if you think about 9 line graphs, they're probably hard to all take in at the same time. But if you can listen to them, it really like brings another level to the understanding of the data.
Producer and life logger Craig Elate talking with Matt Kenny. Matt's a hacker, researcher, and artist who's getting his MFA in new media at Penn State University. When Stephen Wolfram was just 17, he dropped out of college. By the time he was 21, he had a PhD in physics, and he was one of the first recipients of a MacArthur Genius Award. Well, today, he designs widely used software for mathematicians and scientists, but he is also an obsessive self-tracker with what is likely the largest personal data set in the world. Steve Paulson asked him about it.
Lots of people are keeping life logs these days, but you have been accumulating a massive data set about yourself for decades. Can you take me back to the 1980s and why you started doing this?
Oh, it's easy to collect data, and I've been interested in data, and so I just started collecting it. And each different type of data, I had a different reason to want to collect. Like, I collect my keystroke logs of every key that I type on a computer because one day I lost some stuff that I was doing on a computer when the computer crashed, and I figured, let's not do that again. Let's just record everything that I type, and that way I can always reconstruct what I did. But then I've managed to keep the systems running well enough that I now have kind of 25 years of data about lots of kinds of things about myself.
So give me just a brief rundown of some of the different kinds of things you're collecting right now.
Oh, gosh, let's see. Well, I mean, right now, I just, like 3 or 4 months ago, I started collecting continuous heart rate data because it got easy enough to just wear a watch that collects heart rate data and, you know, skin temperature and all kinds of other things like that. I don't yet know what that stuff means. I probably could figure out whether I'm having a good time or not on this interview so far by looking at all of that, but I don't yet know how to interpret it.
Okay. What else are you collecting?
Let's see. On my computer screen, I capture an image of the screen every 15 seconds or so. So I can get kind of a time-lapse video of what I do all day, which is actually it's shockingly boring to watch. Then I guess I get everything to do with email, you know, all my meeting calendar stuff correlated with email. I guess I just, I happened to go on some trip to the opposite side of the earth a couple of weeks ago with a couple of my kids. And I was sort of interested in the jet lag problem. And so I said, OK, I'll try and collect in detail data about myself and the jet lag that I did or didn't have. You know, I've been collecting for ages. When do I go to sleep? When do I wake up? But a little bit more data around that. And hopefully from that, it'll be possible to understand, given also some of the external data that we have about, you know, when did the sun come up? How bright was it that day? Be able to figure out something interesting about what causes or ameliorates jet lag and so on.
So you're collecting just massive amounts of data about yourself and about your surroundings, and I assume you analyze this data in some way. What have you learned about yourself?
Look, I wouldn't collect this data if it wasn't easy to do. These systems, they just sit, they collect the data. If I have to think hard about them, it isn't going to happen. I suppose when I first started looking at this data, maybe 15 years ago or so now, and I learned a few things about sort of the way that was most efficient for me to work, to process email every day and so on. I also learned things about trying to figure out when do I have new ideas about things. You know, when I'm designing software and so on, there comes a moment when I've invented some term for something and I can go back and look, when did I first use that term? How does it grow from there?
I mean, I could imagine that the one point of this would just be you want to learn about yourself. You want to kind of get a picture of who you are. And then another reason would be you want to sort of change your behavior. I mean, you want to do things more efficiently, better somehow because of
yes.
what you learn.
Yes. You know, I think the best thing for that is that I get feedback every day about sort of what I did the last day. You know, how many keystrokes did I type? How many steps did I walk? Those kinds of things. And I do get a pretty decent sense of, oh, what things really, you know, send me into unproductivity and what don't.
So the more keystrokes, the more productive then?
Typically, yes. So I've tried to organize my life so I don't do too many things where I have to put work in, but it isn't productive.
Yeah.
When there are keystrokes, something is being created. That's usually the principle for me, at least, I'm happy to say.
This is fascinating. I mean, basically, you're saying you can look at your behavioral patterns and you can figure out when you are most creative, when you come up with your best ideas. And presumably, you can kind of organize your behavior to maximize those peak moments.
Yeah, yeah. What's been important to me is when the data is easy enough to sort of analyze, and I've built quite a few tools to analyze this data, then when you have a specific question, it actually makes sense to go analyze that question. Like, you know, I get a new computer keyboard. I ask, is it faster or slower to type on my new computer keyboard? Well, if that was going to take me more than 5 minutes to answer, I probably wouldn't bother. If I have tools set up so that it only takes me 5 minutes to answer that, I'm going to end up with my better keyboard that's, you know, 3% faster to type on or something. The main thing that I've learned is, first of all, it's like collect all the data. Don't put too much effort into collecting the data because if you've put a lot of effort, you know, you'll stop doing it after a while. Then the other thing is you've got to have tools to analyze things that are efficient enough that when you have a question about yourself, for example, you can actually go and with reasonably modest effort get some answer to that question. One of the things I'd like to be able to do is, you know, how much of my responding to email could I replace with a bot? One of the things that I sort of just started getting into is the question of, given all the data that I have on what I end up doing, how much of the what I end up doing is actually completely predictable? In other words, to what extent can I essentially have an algorithm that just does what I would do, so to speak? Which would be nice, because then I can do something different.
Right, yes. Well, by now, you must have one of the largest personal data sets ever collected, I'm guessing.
I think I probably do. Yeah, it was funny because a couple of years ago, I wrote some stuff about this, and I kind of expected that people would come out and say, oh, you think you've collected a lot of data, but that's nothing compared to what I've got. But nobody, people said, well, I've got a small fraction of what you've got. And I have to say, I found it kind of shocking because one would think the person who's collected the most data in the world must be the nerdiest person out there. And that's not my self-image, at least.
It's fascinating to hear all the stuff that you do. And the picture that I'm getting is that you're just fascinated by this stuff. Partly it's things that you can do with this information. Part of it is just, this is your way of understanding the world. And also, more specifically, understanding yourself, who you are.
I don't know. It's one facet of that, at least. It's kind of interesting. It gives one a certain reality to one's impressions of oneself, where one can actually see this plot that shows, yes, my impression is that I do this, but look, here's an actual curve, and I can tell from this curve that really is what I do. And sometimes one sees things where it's like, I didn't realize this is a gradual thing that's changing over the course of years, but one can see it in the data, and when one thinks about it, yes, that's really what's happening. It's kind of like, can you get an automated historian that can pull out sort of interesting things, interesting kind of themes about what's going on?
So let me tell you one scenario that I can imagine in terms of how this data can be used to affect what we do in daily life. I mean, just as we subscribe to online music services that find new songs that match our tastes, we're going to have apps, I'm sure we already do to some degree, that tell us what books to read, what films to see, what restaurants to eat at, all based on our likes and dislikes, which politicians to vote for. I mean, basically, we will become perfect consumers in all walks of life. Do you see this as our future?
Well, I think the real question is the future of people to follow what the auto-suggest systems of their computers tell them to do? I mean, in other words, right now, you go driving somewhere, you'll typically follow what your GPS tells you to do. You'll look for recommendations for things. You'll often follow what the recommendations say. One of the questions is, at what point do those recommendations get to be better than what any human can reasonably figure out about what one should do? And I think the answer is that will definitely happen. I mean, it's very easy for our computer systems to have much more information about our history, how we've responded to different things in the past, and so on, than we can readily think through with our brains.
But if we really do outsource all these choices to our machines, to algorithms, have we lost free will at that point?
Well, I think that's the interesting thing, that we have an artificial intelligence. I've spent lots of time building components of what's needed to make sort of a complete artificial intelligence, so to speak. But even if you have one of these things, it does not intrinsically have goals about what it's trying to do. You can have this incredibly smart box sitting on your desk. You can ask it questions and it can respond with sort of the best wisdom that can be achieved, so to speak. But with intelligence doesn't come goals. Goals are a sort of separate thing. And goals that humans have tend to be things that come from sort of the long history of culture and civilization and individual histories of individual humans and so on. Unless one's AI has essentially the exact same experiences that the human has and has the exact same constraints that the human has, there's no intrinsic sense of having goals in the ways that humans have them. My view of where we're going with technology and automation and so on is, and it's really just a continuation of what's happened for a long time. The humans define the goals, the machines do the best they can to achieve those goals as efficiently as possible. And the goals that we can define are becoming more and more sophisticated, but still, just left to its own devices, the machine doesn't know what to do.
Now, it seems like one of your big projects, I mean, to look at various aspects of your company, for instance, is to democratize knowledge by making data, by making powerful computational technologies accessible pretty much to everyone. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, yeah. That's an exciting thing, that one can take what has been kind of knowledge and computation that's accessible only to experts and make it possible for anyone anywhere to be able to do that. I mean, it's kind of been a goal that I've had since I was a kid, actually, to see whether one could take sort of the knowledge that's been accumulated in our civilization and make it so that if there are questions that can in principle be answered on the basis of that knowledge, it becomes automatic and efficient to do that. You know, I wasn't sure in which decade one could actually build a practical system that would make that possible. Turned out it was, pretty much this decade. It's been great to be around at a time when sort of that transition is happening and to be able to make a system that does that.
Stephen Wolfram is a computer scientist and the CEO of Wolfram Research. Steve Paulson talked with him. Now, you may be thinking that you have nothing in common with all these self-trackers, but let me ask you this. Have you ever kept a diary? Writer Sarah Manguso has for 25 years, and coming up, we'll talk about what she's learned. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking about the current obsession with digital life logging, but you don't necessarily need fancy technology to pay obsessive attention to the details of your life. And people have been keeping diaries and journals for centuries. Writer Sarah Manguso keeps a daily diary, and she has complicated feelings about it. Her new book, Ongoingness, is a short meditation on journal writing and also about how becoming a new mother changed her feelings about living her life on a page. Steve Paulson asked her to read a passage from the beginning.
I started keeping a diary 25 years ago. It's 800,000 words long. I didn't want to lose anything. That was my main problem. I couldn't face the end of a day without a record of everything that had ever happened. I wrote about myself so I wouldn't become paralyzed by rumination, so I could stop thinking about what had happened and be done with it. More than that, I wrote so I could say I was truly paying attention. Experience in itself wasn't enough. The diary was my defense against waking up at the end of my life and realizing I'd missed it. Imagining life without the diary, even 1 week without it, spurred a panic that I might as well be dead.
Sarah, it seems like you set up an almost impossible task for yourself, as if your diary could be a record of your entire life. Is that kind of what you were trying to do?
That is exactly what I was trying to do, yes. And I did understand in very basic terms that it's essentially impossible to keep a record of every moment of one's life, all the sensory information and all of the words that were spoken and all of the things that I thought. But I still had this anxiety that I had to maintain the diary anyway. I had to at least try. It felt, as I say in the book, as necessary to my hygiene as bathing.
So this gives you pleasure, it sounds like, to write in your diary every day.
Pleasure and also very much a kind of relief.
Now, you say that keeping this diary became an absolute compulsion, and that became a problem. I mean, you call it a vice.
I call it a vice in order to kind of counteract the immediate response of people say, oh, that's so virtuous. I attempt to do that every January. I make a New Year's resolution, or I don't have the discipline. And really, the practice of keeping my diary was something utterly outside willpower or discipline. In fact, it would have taken willpower and discipline not to keep it. That's why I call it a vice in the book. In my 20s, I stopped to write every time I happened upon beauty. It was an old-fashioned project. Romances were examined in detail. Each one was new. My 30s were filled not by romance, but by other writing. Virtuous activities such as exercise and housekeeping also were logged. The rhapsodies of the previous decade thinned out. Toward the end of my 30s and into my 40s, entries became further abbreviated. Most of the sentences started with verbs. I is omitted from as many sentences as possible, occurring only for emphasis. I logged work and health, symptoms, medications, side effects. Housekeeping was no longer noted. If I read or looked at or heard something extraordinary, I named it. But as one ages, fewer things fall into this category. Reflection disappeared almost completely.
And my sense is that the biggest change came once you became pregnant and your son was born. Why did that have such a big impact on what you did in your diary?
Well, I was prepared for all the cliches of parenthood, the exhaustion, simply just not having enough time. But those things weren't what ultimately arrested my obsessive daily maintenance of the diary. What arrested it was that I started inhabiting time in a new way. I realized that I was simultaneously forgetting more than I'd ever thought I could bear, and I was also remembering more than I'd ever thought I could.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that the experience of pregnancy and motherhood changed the way you thought about memory, about time itself, and about writing.
Yes, all of those things changed. The other strange thing that happened to my memory very soon after I gave birth to my son is that these very old pre-verbal memories started to surface. And I had always been such a doubter whenever anybody would say, oh, I have this very early memory of going hiking in the rainforest with my father when I was 4 months old. I can remember the way the trees looked, or I remember what it was like to be in my playpen or my crib. And I just thought, oh, you know, you've seen a photograph. This has all been projected onto you. You've listened to people describing these events. I just didn't believe it. I didn't have any pre-verbal memories of my own. And so it seemed impossible. But I had so many experiences of being with this pre-verbal creature, my tiny son. And as I was feeding him with a spoon one day, if you've ever fed a baby with a spoon, you know,
it's very messy, I might say.
It's not quite as simple as just delivering the food via the spoon into the baby's mouth. I mean, you attempt that. Some of the food, you know, reaches its goal, and then much of the rest of it sort of dribbles down the baby's chin and jaw. And one of the first times I ever did that, I suddenly had this incredibly vivid sense memory of someone doing that to me, of feeling the spoon scraping my chin, and of tasting that already tasted food and feeling, ugh, you know, this dribbled food, this pre-tasted food doesn't taste as good as the food that got in during the first attempt at feeding me. It really felt as though my memory were trying to help me understand what it was like to be my son. It was like this emergency empathy.
Do you think you were actually remembering something that happened to you when maybe you were a year old or even less?
I really do think that, because the most vivid of these early memories was a memory of being in my crib, and the collection of sense memories around this was just so vivid and they were so extensive. There was this panel on my crib that was orange, and it had a lot of little things that I could twiddle with. There was a crank that I could turn. There was a bell that I could ring. The bell was silver. I know what the screw looked like. There was a mirror. It was in the bottom left-hand corner. I can see it. I can hear it. I can feel it in my hand. And I know I've never seen a photograph of it.
Well, it seems that there's kind of a profound philosophical question here. I mean, if our sense of self is basically built on our memories, what happens if our memories change? I mean, does our sense of self change?
I don't know. I don't know whether my sense of self changed, but certainly my beliefs about the role of memory, and certainly about the roles of enforced memory through keeping a diary, were changed utterly by this experience. I've been basically the same person since I had my son. I know this isn't true for all new mothers, especially those who are younger than I am, and most of them are, but I feel like a monolith now. I've emerged from a gauntlet, and it has something to do with having become a mother, and it has something to do with having become qualitatively old, and it has something to do with having run out of time and life to perceive and ruminate and record my minutes and days in the diary. What I'm saying is that I have become, in a way, inured to the passage of time. I'm not really paying attention to what's happening to me anymore, no longer observing steadfastly the things that have changed since yesterday.
Now, one of the central tensions in your book is whether writing this diary got in the way of living. I mean, of actually experiencing the world rather than kind of always observing it from a distance. Have you sorted this out?
Well, I think the tension between the need to record and the need to do anything but record is less terrifying to me now than it once was. There's a sort of bittersweet anecdote in the book about declining a ride from New York to Boston with a friend who would only live a few more years. But, you know, of course, not knowing that at the time, I said, no, you know, I'm going to take the Greyhound so I can just sit and write in this little book for 4 hours, because the need for me to do that is greater than the need for me to be with my friend. I'm less likely to make that choice now.
Sarah Manguzzo's book is called Ongoingness, The End of a Diary. She talked with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by our public humanities scholar, Craig Ely. He's with us thanks to a fellowship from the American Council of Learned Societies. And Craig also tracked a bit of this hour and created a website for it full of cool data visualizations and a bunch of other stuff. You can find it at ttbook.org/QS. Today's show was also produced by Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Sarah Nix. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.